What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. I am Chris DeFrancesco, and this episode is going to sound a little bit different. Just a little bit. It's going to sound a little bit more feminine, to be exact. So over the last, let's just see, I've done over 100 episodes of the Hot Tag now. Over the last few years, every once in a while when I do a Q&A, or, you know, we're in a deep conversation about, you know, wrestling pay-per-views from the late 80s into the early 90s, I always make sure I bring up, you know, the reason that I was watching wrestling back then. And on the show with me this week to cover one of the most near and dear pay-per-views to me, and it's very highly requested as well, is the reason that I am a wrestling fan, the reason that my parents probably, you know, despise the fact that I even watch professional wrestling, is my aunt, which is my dad's sister, Nancy DeFrancesco. How you doing?
Hi, Chris. Good. How are you doing?
Doing the best that I can. I cannot complain. And just to let everybody know, it's not like she's some 70-year-old woman. My aunt here is only about, what, 7 years older than me?
Yeah, exactly. So, pretty much exactly 7 years. I'm 42.
Right. Yeah. And I'm 35, going to be 36, because you're November 26th and I'm the 30th. Right?
Yes.
Okay. Whew, thank God I remembered that.
I remember when he was born.
That's a long time ago. It's insane. So tonight we're going to cover SummerSlam 1994, which, you know, to spoil it for Nancy and to let y'all know, she completely forgot that this even existed. She, when I talked to her about it on the phone, she said, oh, well, I actually do not recall. That might have been when I was out of wrestling, which is weird, Nance, because I actually don't remember a time except for the Attitude Era that you were out of wrestling, because Brett was in his prime in 94.
Yeah, I am a huge Bret Hart mark, which has been a kind of source of contention between Chris and I over the years.
We've love Bret now, by the way.
Little battles between, you know, but if Bret can forgive Sean, then I can. But anyway.
Then you can forgive your first nephew. That's great.
I was when I reflect back on the time, I was 14 years old in 1994. So I was entering into high school. Yeah. So, you know, the whole adolescent, fantasy of Bret Hart, like, you know, once I met like real live boys in the flesh, it was just less interesting. And then ironically, I started to get back into it once I was in college.
Okay.
And I've been,
yeah. It's funny, if I meet Shawn Michaels at 35 in the flesh, I feel like an adolescent teenager. So it's,
well, I mean, when I met Brett, you know how that was.
Yeah, that was fun. That's one of those moments. It's like, you know, there's moments in your life that you try to black out and kind of never, ever try to remember. That's one of those moments where, man, I'll never, ever forget anything like that, which is pretty awesome. All right. So before we get into SummerSlam 1994, which was best known, unfortunately, for the wrong match, was best known for Undertaker versus Undertaker. We will cover Bret versus Owen, which I think is, I mean, one of the best matches ever. I think it was, I even think it was better than the WrestleMania 10 match. And that's even with a gimmick being the steel cage, but we'll get into that. I'm going to give you guys a rundown of the rest of the year. And I like to do months by in terms of the pay-per-view. So right now, you know, SummerSlam just happened to be early. It was July 30th or 31st.
Too early.
Yeah. But we are still in SummerSlam coverage for one more week after this. We have SummerSlam 94 this week and then SummerSlam 2001 coming to you next week. So here is the docket for the rest of 2022 before we take all of December off to prepare for 2023. So like I said, next week is SummerSlam 2001. September or the end of August, we are going to get into In Your House 10 Mind Games, which was headlined by Shawn Michaels versus Mankind for the WWF title. That was in Philadelphia, by the way, everybody, which was the, go ahead.
I think I was there.
If you were there, I'm very, very hurt that you never told me that, because that's like one of the most respected, highly touted main events over the past
what
like
year
years.
Was it?
1996.
I think I was there.
That was the very first event.
I got hit on the head by somebody.
Oh, of course you would remember that. That was the very first event
I was
at the
cheering.
New
Mankind.
Oh, of course you were cheering Mankind. That was the very first event held inside the new Wells Fargo Center. Well, then I think it was called the Core State Center. Then we're going to get into Unforgiven 2000, Unforgiven 2002, then Unforgiven 2006. Let's get into the final two. Now we're in October. We're going to go back to WCW coverage. We're going to cover Halloween Havoc 1994, Rage in the Cage. That was Hulk Hogan versus Ric Flair inside a salad steel cage. That salad was a joke on a podcast I listened to. And then we're going to cover Halloween Havoc 1998, which is one of the most famous wrestling pay-per-views of all time for the wrong reasons, but we cannot wait to cover Hulk Hogan versus the Ultimate Warrior part two in WCW. Just an absolute nightmare, and I'm so excited for that. Then we're going to round out October with No Mercy 2000 and No Mercy 2001. And then November, which is Survivor Series season, we kind of went over this and we felt that we've had a lot of requests for the early 2000 Survivor Series because of how good they were, especially what was going on around the company. So we're going to cover straight from 2000 through Survivor Series 2003. We're going to cover all of those because last November we covered those mid-90s Survivor Series, which were really hard to get through. That's the rest of the year for the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. And then like normal, we will take all of December off to focus on family, Christmas, have a good time, reboot, and get ready for Royal Rumble season, which we will cover a bunch of Rumbles as well. But now let's get to the reason we are here. Nancy, should I assume the first time you watched this pay-per-view was yesterday?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, I'm not sure why I wasn't more into it, but because yes, yesterday was the first time.
Okay. All right. So now, like what I always like to do is let everybody know the money situation having to do with these pay-per-views. And 1994 was the beginning, like the first year of about 3 or 4 years in a row where this company was in dire straits of even keeping their doors open. And I'm going to kind of give you guys a hint as to why. So let's go to 1993, the year before this. SummerSlam 1993 had 250,000 pay-per-view buys. Not bad, not good, but it's not awful. Let's go to this year, 1994. 235,000 pay-per-view buys, 23,000 fans paid a live gate of $386,000. That was the second highest of the year of 94. So not awful. However, they're still down 15,000 buys. It gets kind of worse after this. 1995 SummerSlam, 205,000 pay-per-view buys. 1996, which many regard as one of the years of kind of like a turning point near the end of the year, heading into 97, which was an unbelievable turning point year. 1996, which was headlined by Vader and Shawn Michaels, 157,000 pay-per-view buys. Just really, really bad. But then you go into 1997, 250,000. And then the Stone Cold Steve Austin effect really hit the company in 1998. 655,000 pay-per-view buys in 1998. That was Highway to Hell, Madison Square Garden. That was Stone Cold versus The Undertaker. But let's get into SummerSlam 94, which occurred August 29th, 1994, inside the United Center in Chicago, Illinois.
Yep.
Here we go. We've got some pre-show notes. The WWF title picture saw WWE champion Bret the Hitman Hart having to defend the gold against his brother Owen in a steel cage match. Owen beat Bret at WrestleMania 10 on the same night that Bret won the WWF title later that evening. Then Owen won the King of the Ring 2 months before this. So he went into the match with a lot of momentum. The other main story was the return of The Undertaker. He was off for about 7 months after being killed by Yokozuna at the Royal Rumble 1994, thanks to the help of another, 12, 13 guys on the roster. However, for real, he had a back injury. So this was a way to write him out and allow him to heal up. Yeah, let's kill a guy on pay-per-view and tell him to go away for a little bit with a back injury. His original manager, Ted DiBiase, brought The Undertaker back, quote unquote, but it wasn't the real guy. So the main event of this show is the real Undertaker against the imposter. Oh.
Or as I read somewhere, the Underfaker.
Underfaker. Man, this is 1994 WWF. Let's just say, to me, they picked the wrong match to go on last in this pay-per-view, and we'll get into that.
Okay, good.
The legendary Randy Savage makes his entrance with a microphone as he welcomed us to the show at the brand new United
New Generation.
Center. Yes. He talked about the New Generation era. He passed things off to announcers Vince McMahon and Jerry Lawler. Lawler mentioned that Shawn Michaels and Diesel won the tag titles one night earlier from the Head Shrinkers. That was a time where WWF were becoming habitual in terms of title changes on house shows. I mean, we would see, what was it, in late 94, right? I want to say 94, maybe early 95, where at a house show, Diesel beat Bob Backlund for the WWF title.
And same thing. That's how Brett became champion.
Yeah.
He beat Ric Flair at a house show. I think I want to say 92.
92 was a Coliseum home video recording. So yeah, it was a house show. Just crazy. Just think about this. Like 2 months after this, Savage was gone from the WWF completely. He was 41 years old at the time. And at this point was not used that much in the ring. He ended up in WCW in 1995 while never coming back to WWF, sadly. Although WWF, you know, didn't do many events in the United Center. They preferred the Rosemont Horizon, which is now the Allstate Arena. The United Center is big, but you know, a lot of WWF, you know, legends praise the Allstate Arena as one of their favorite places. I mean, this is 23,000 people that sold out this event. You know, we're talking about, it's funny, and I say this often, Nance, about age, how different age is nowadays. You know, at this time, they just said Savage was 41 years old and Vince thought that he was done, you know, not worthy anymore. It's 2022. AJ Styles is 45 and he's arguably the best wrestler in the world. Edge is what, 47?
I want to say 48. Randy Orton is my age. He's 42.
Exactly. It's just eight. Finn Balor's 40. You know, it's
just turned 40. Yeah. Yeah.
It's incredible how things change where, you know, you look at it this way. Stone Cold's career ended at 38 years old. Shinsuke Nakamura became like Intercontinental Champion or like was in the hunt for the title on you know, Raw at 38 years old. And if, you know, if Shinsuke's career was cut short, you'd be like, man, he was just getting started. Like, it's incredible how time changes age in the business.
Yeah. It was something I was thinking about too. Also, of course, technology, you know, having the internet at our fingertips, being able to just open up your phone and see, like you said, title changes, injury reports.
Yeah. It's not what it used
to be. Contract status.
Yeah. Yeah. Like in 94, to find out something like this, you either have to, one, order SummerSlam to find out that there was a title change the night before, or you have to wait till Monday Night Raw to hear anything about it. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of sometimes wish it went back to that era because I would love to continuously be shocked with things before, you know,
still live in kayfabe.
I would love to live in kayfabe. All right, so here we go. First match, Bam Bam Bigelow and IRS versus the Head Shrinkers. The winners by disqualification were Bam Bam and IRS. I gave this match about a star. I thought the match was okay. Had a very poor finish.
Wasn't it? It was funny to me to see IRS and to think, wow, that is Bray Wyatt's father.
I know.
And the Head Shrinkers music, oh my God. It was bad.
It is, yeah.
But it was just, it's funny because I don't know if you watched SmackDown the other night with Sheamus and Drew McIntyre with the Donnybrook.
Yes.
At one point, one of the guys used that word, Donnybrook.
Donnybrook.
God, it's God. A word.
Was that that had
either
been
McMahon or Lawler. Probably McMahon.
Probably. That's a Vinceism, yeah. You know, everybody in the match were solid workers. They just didn't have a good showing. The chemistry was just off. It was turning into a decent match, I thought, but that finish was really bad. It was as if... Good.
It was pointless.
It was.
There was nothing on the line, nothing at stake. They lost the titles the night before.
I agree. Let's see. There was a backstage vignette with actor Leslie Nielsen, who's, you know, for those youngins that are listening to this podcast, he's a very famous, you know, comedic, you know, Canadian comedic actor back in the day for those Naked Gun movies. God, just please do yourself a favor and go watch those movies. just disregard OJ being in them, but he was really good in those movies. He was looking for the Undertaker. He thought he found him, but instead he found his buddy, actor George Kennedy, who was also in the Naked Gun movies. They said they looked for him together. All right. Next match here. WWF Women's title, Alondra Blaze versus Bull Nakano. The winner by pinfall was Alondra Blaze. And you know what's funny, Nance? I went into this match thinking, all right, it's another, you know, I always liked Alondra Blaze or Medusa. I just felt like she was way ahead of her time in terms of, you know, it was really hard to find somebody that could, you know, you weren't going to 1994 and you weren't going to find a Becky Lynch to go up against Alondra Blaze. You just weren't going to find them. But I'll tell you what. Go ahead.
I mean, the women's division, three women. That was it.
I know. Luna, you know, and they were all so, here.
I mean, it was such a good match.
It like, really was. Wow. I was stunned. I gave it three and a half stars. You know, Nakano did well, I thought, as an overpowering heel. She used submission holds. And then Blaze had a great babyface comeback. Yeah. And you almost forgot that there were, you know, great WWF, you know, women's matches in this period. But thanks to these two, they put together just a phenomenal match here. You know, they really tried to look like this division was legitimate, but overall in the long run, it just didn't work out because a little over a year after this, Blaze went to WCW. That killed the division for a while until they pushed Sable in the Attitude Era. So, but overall, man, these women, you know, they beat the crap out of each other in this match.
Yeah, it was really good.
Mm-hmm. Here we go. In the back, Shawn Michaels and Diesel were interviewed by Todd Pettengill. They're the tag team champs, and Diesel's the Intercontinental Champion as well. They were heels, so Michaels bragged about having so much gold. Diesel said that his name should be Midas because everybody he touches turns to gold. He said he likes where they are. He told Razor Ramon it's not going to happen tonight. Michael said they're not worried about the NFL Hall of Famer Walter Payton at ringside, and then they left. Diesel and Michaels entered. I don't agree with leaving Michaels off the card in terms of match because of just how great he was in 94. I get why they did it since Razor had someone in his corner as well. You know, for those of you who don't know who Walter Payton is, he's one of the greatest NFL players of all time, and he was a Chicago Bear.
Played for the Bears.
Yep, and his nickname was Sweetness, for those who don't know. Analysis on this match for me was, you know, it was a smart move by WWF to use Payton for this. He was about 40 years old here, and he looked like he was in phenomenal shape. For those who know, he died about 5 years later in 1999 at age 45 with liver disease. But I'll tell you what, I thought this match was pretty good. And, you know, Diesel wasn't the best worker at all.
Yeah, he was very green at the time.
Very. But damn, this match showed you how great Scott Hall was when he was level-headed. And were you a Razor fan back then?
Yeah, back then I was before I knew better. Because I was your typical, you know, I rooted for the faces and I didn't like the heels.
But you never liked Hogan.
No, I did. I did until I discovered Bret Hart.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started to, you know, WrestleMania 9, that killed me.
It killed everybody.
Yeah. WrestleMania 10 was such a, you know, and that's what I had to keep reminding myself that just a few months before that April, and WrestleMania 10 was a pay-per-view that I definitely ordered. In fact, that might have been the one that you saw at my house because
maybe.
My mom knew how my mother, Chris's grandmother, mm-hmm. knew how excited I was about it. And she was like, you know what? Let's just pay the $50, $60 and we'll order it. And Chris happened to be coming over that night with his parents. And
wow.
Oh my God.
That's wild.
So yeah.
28 years ago.
Yeah. And then there were certain things watching this last night that, because like I remember like thinking, why wasn't the Undertaker at WrestleMania 10? And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, because he was dead. And I even remember getting the WWF magazines at the time, and there was an article like, you know, like it was kind of like, oh, Undertaker is spotted at all these places. But anyway, I'm sorry.
I used to love coming over and you had all the WWF the magazines. Yeah. That was how I was able to keep up and learn things. I always read the magazines, you know, after they were all cut out with every single Bret Hart photo, I was still able to read articles, which was always good. But man, they are my favorite times being able to go read those magazines because my dad, who is what they say, frugal. So I was never able to get a WWF magazine subscription. But yeah, that was always so much fun. But yeah, a little fun fact about this match with Walter Payton, Bruce Pritchard talked about this, how when they were going over the match, literally like breaking it down piece by piece, there was like a couple points where Sean and Razor forgot the spots. What are we going to do here? What are we going to do there? And apparently Walter Payton came right in and said, no, this is what we're supposed to be doing right here, right here, right here, right here. And literally he was able to let the wrestlers know what they were doing in each spot. And he had only heard everything once. And a lot of people say they credit to, you know, when you're a football player, you got to learn a playbook really fast. So a lot of people have like said, like Walter Payton literally could map out that match like Vince McMahon would. And he only heard the scenarios one time. So it's pretty impressive. It's pretty cool where
that
you hear,
is really cool.
Yeah. When you hear a celebrity back then, you know, focusing and really paying attention to the product, which is really good. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the few things that I was thinking as the match was occurring was just, you know, like this is the click before the click.
Yep.
The only member missing from the curtain call incident was, you know, Triple H, but I don't think he was around by that point.
Not yet. He was still terrorizing.
I just thought of that term that they like to use, two meaty men slapping meat.
That's hilarious. You know, they told a basic story with Diesel in control for most of the match, Ramon fighting back and finding his way to win to become the new Intercontinental Champion.
And how did that happen? Because the Heartbreak Kid accidentally super kicked Diesel in the face.
Yep.
So they started to plant those little seeds for Diesel's face turn.
Yeah, because the following WrestleMania was Diesel versus Shawn for the title. Yep. So the crowd treated this like a major title change because of, you know, Peyton was there to support Ramon. I thought it was a great booking, a great solid match. They showed the Macho Man, Randy Savage on camera, congratulating Razor for the title win. It was a great match. It really was. So, you know, the crowd was treated to two back-to-back very good matches. And then it kind of goes down a little bit after this. So here comes everybody's favorite Indian, Tatanka and Lex Luger.
Native American, Chris.
I'm sorry. My bad. Native American. We're interviewed by Pettengill in the locker room. He read some WWF opinion poll on the hotline.
Did Lex sell out?
Yep. 54% of the people thinking that Luger sold out to Ted DiBiase. Tatanka said everybody's going to find out Luger sold out. What I want to do, if I was like an alcoholic, I would have loved to play the game where you take a shot of like Terramana rock tequila every time Tatanka said you sold out or just the word sold out. I would literally die of alcohol poisoning because it was just nonstop repetitive with him. However, we get to this match. I remember going into this thinking I had no idea what they were going to do because there was like no long-term build up to this. And, you know, to me, I thought,
Two faces,
which Vince never really liked doing. But if he was going to do it, why are you doing it with Tatanka and Lex Luger? I just felt like they brought in Lex. They tried to make him out to be the next Hulk Hogan. Clearly did not work. Now it's just like, well, what the hell are we going to do with the guy? I know. Let's put him with the Native American. Winner by pinfall was Tatanka. I gave this 1 star because the word that I used for this match, Nance, was slow.
Yeah.
Very, very slow and boring.
Well, the Million Dollar Man played a big part. Part of the reason why Luger lost was because Ted DiBiase comes down at some point with a bag, distracts Luger, and I believe Tatanka got a pin by like a roll-up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It happened so quickly.
Roll-up of death.
Yeah. And then, and that was the main part. The main point of it was just, it was a vehicle for Tatanka to be able to have his heel turn.
Yes. Yep.
And he beat the crap out of Lex Luger.
Mm-hmm.
And
eventually,
stuck the money in his face.
Mm-hmm. It was a shocking turn. The best thing about it was the build they did leading up to it, because it took months, I guess, to get to this point. So, you know, these days they rush those kinds of things, but, you know, they didn't have 7 hours of television back then to rush storylines and see these things. You know, back then, a rivalry could last 6 months because you only saw it once a week. You know, Raw was an hour back then.
And there was no Instagram or Twitter or, you know, whatever you youngins used to Snapchat. Twitter.
Yes, that's it.
The Twitter wars.
Yes.
Yeah, they didn't have any of that to go back and forth. So whatever time that they got with Todd Pettengale, I remember him. Yes. That was what they had. That mm-hmm. just it took a little long for, you know, getting to see Lex get the crap beat out of him. I was like, all right, already.
I know. And it's, you know, long term, Tatanka was an awful heel. There was just nothing ever believable about him as a heel. He wasn't going to go anywhere as a babyface either. But that heel turn, I thought, was a bad move for him. The only thing I really liked about Tatanka, I, for some reason, really loved his entrance song. So other than that, I really couldn't care. But, you know, nonetheless.
He had a defeated streak. I don't know if you remember that. But that
yes, he was. For how long?
Thing. It was a while.
I think it was a while. It wasn't Goldberg, but it was a while.
No. And I, for some reason, I had thought that Yokozuna broke it on one of those Saturday morning shows, but I read that it was Ludwig Borga. Yeah.
God. Next match here, we'll do this match before we take a break. That we can come back on the other side and talk about Brett Owen. So Jeff Jarrett versus Mabel. Winner by pinfall was Jeff Jarrett. Look, I'm a big Jeff Jarrett fan. I love Jeff Jarrett. I loved him in TNA. I liked him back then too. One of my favorite matches ever is his Intercontinental title match against Shawn Michaels. I thought it was just amazing. But on this night, just bad, 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 bad. Just bad.
I read that it was supposed to be Doink the Clown yes. for whatever reason. And I don't know what happened to Doink, but he was replaced with Mabel.
Yeah.
So, and at some point, and I barely remember this guy, Abe Knuckleball Schwartz, a disgruntled baseball player in face paint, came down through the crowd and that went nowhere.
Pretty sure that was the Brooklyn Brawler.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's who played him.
Yeah.
Look, you know, it was a bad match, although they did the best they could considering how limited Mabel was, because he was just a massive human being. You know, at least the crowd seemed to care about it a little bit more. You know, a year later, Mabel headlined SummerSlam against Diesel. That match was awful, too. But the moral of the story for this is, you know, Vince McMahon just loved pushing big guys. And it's just that's just the way he was. He saw a guy like Diesel. I mean, look, he's a beautiful dude. He's intelligent. He was just very charismatic. So, yeah, push him. And then when you see a big, prodding, massive Mabel, I got to push him, too. And I look, it was 1994. The bloom was off the rose at this point. You know, fans are really starting to push away from the big men, as you can, you know, tell with where Brett ended up being Michaels. You know, Diesel was literally the worst drawing champion in the history of WWF. So it's, you know, the company was starting to move away from that, but I mean, the fans were, but Vince just loved it. Loved his big men. The search for the Undertaker continued with Nielsen and Kennedy by the entrance. They turned around to see a purple light teasing that it was Taker. Then they went back to that again. There were videos that aired showing the buildup to Bret Hart versus Owen, going back to Survivor Series 1993. It also showed King of the Ring 1994 when Owen won that tournament, while Jim Neidhart helped him win and helped Bret keep his title so that Owen could beat him. That's 9 months of a buildup to this very WWF title match, and you just don't see those kinds of builds anymore. And then they aired promos for both guys as well. The cage surrounding the ring is in, you know, the big old blue cage that is much easier to climb up compared to the silver steel cage, which basically was fencing that would be used later on. It was shown being constructed, which I love. I love those old school blue cages. But what we're going to do here is before we get to the match, we are going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we got Brett versus Owen for the WWF title. And then we got the main event of main events, The Undertaker versus The Undertaker here at Survivor Series 1994. That's Nancy, and I'm Chrissy Francesco.
Spoiler alert, Undertaker wins.
Yes, I know. We'll be right back in just a few seconds. Stand by. Welcome back, Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. I'm Chrissy Francesco. Nancy DeFrancesco is joining us. That's not a misquote there. That's literally my aunt, which we talked about at the beginning of the show. So, Nance, we just talked about something after we hit the stop button to come back from the break. And you brought up a great point. If you would like to elaborate and repeat that, for I won't listen because I've already heard it. But but go ahead. What were you talking about in terms of long-term storytelling?
Sure. Well, before the break, you were saying how the whole storyline between Brett and Owen started in Survivor Series 1993, escalated at the Royal Rumble, though I don't recall everything that happened at the Royal Rumble. And then ultimately, you know, they met with each other at WrestleMania 10 in April. And then that followed up with this match in August for SummerSlam. So mm-hmm. 9 months to tell this story. And I was saying to you, because, you know, one thing I read about when I read all the, like, I like to read cage side seats and stuff like that. A lot of the fans will say, like, oh my God, haven't we seen this match before? And like they're talking about, you know, Brock versus Roman Reigns mm-hmm. for the 11th time, yeah. New Day versus the Usos, those mm-hmm. types of things where it's like, oh my God, I've seen this already. But again, I think it drives home, or it goes back to your point of the New Day and the Usos have the privilege of having at least 5 hours worth of content a week to be able to put their stuff out. Mm-hmm. Plus, again, all the other
all of social media helps out.
Social media, yeah. Right? Whereas, you know, and it's like, what is each thing doing to really further the story, mm-hmm. to elevate it, and to really, again, that the idea of long term storytelling. Whereas, like with this, you know, yes, it took 9 months, but it kept progressing mm-hmm. because by the time, you know, WrestleMania 10, which has a very special place in my heart.
Me too.
WrestleMania 10, like that was the opening match, Brett versus Owen. And yep. You know,
still to this day, the greatest opener of any pay-per-view ever.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. Oh, and, you know, but this one, like, the whole entire Hart, almost all the Hart family was there.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying how, like, during the beginning of the match, or before the match, like, they did a recap. Brett was talking to Todd Pettengale, and he said how he had strep throat. He was always trying to somehow overcome adversity. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, like, I just think it's important to be able to realize, like, the whole idea of repetition was always there.
Yeah.
Yep. You always had programs that lasted like a little while. Again, you have 9 months, but at least there was progression in the stories.
For sure.
Look at where Owen started to where it ended. Like,
high energy.
King of the Ring. Yeah.
Listen, you're not a true fighting champion until you've wrestled with strep throat. Okay. So let's not. It's not, you know, he's probably wrestled.
It doesn't matter. I'll be fine.
I'll be great. I'm good.
Okay.
Let's see. Vince interviewed Stu and Helen Hart at ringside with Lawler, saying the entire family kept Owen down his whole life. Yeah. Davey Boy Smith, which is, you know, British Bulldog, was shown with his wife, Diana Hart, as well. This was his return to the WWF after being with WCW for most of 1993. Jim Neidhart was sitting in the crowd as well with Vince interviewing him. He said, we'll see that Owen is the next WWE champion. Then you got Bret Hart being interviewed by Tom Pettengale. It was noted that Bret was dealing with strep throat. Oh, I feel so bad for him. Bret said he doesn't hate Owen, and he never did. The problem is that Owen is jealous, and it's a horrible thing. Bret thinks that it was Jim Neidhart that started all of this stuff. Said it's like they're caged animals now, so this has to end. Bret spoke about how he's tried to end it, but now he sees this is it. He ended up by saying he's going to beat Owen, and he hopes that Owen can live with it. I thought it was a pretty good promo for Bret. I know people get on him for not being the best talker, but I think when storylines are good, he usually delivered. In this case, after all of his buildup for about 9 months, he was very effective, I thought, in getting his point across. I thought his promos in 94 were good. I thought Bret Hart 1997 was the best Bret Hart I've ever seen. I've literally watched from January 97 all the way, like every single Raw. I've watched every pay-per-view to study it. Bret Hart, damn it, do I wish that he and Vince could have came to some sort of agreement, because Bret Hart in 1997 is unhinged and really unmatched. He should have been a heel so long ago. But, and I say this about Bret, and I used to hate the guy. There's still some things I don't like, but there was things that I disliked about Shawn too. So to me, I just felt like wrestling was always real life to Bret. And I always felt like that aided him in being bitter about a lot of things. He never wanted to become a heel because he felt Canada would hate him for real. It doesn't work that way. It's a work. it's staged, but man, I love watching Bret Hart 1997, and I loved watching Bret Hart 1994. Over the last couple of years, I've grown to really respect and appreciate Bret the Hitman Hart. I think he is the greatest technical performer of all time. I think a very close second, I have no problem saying his name because it's just a fact, is Chris Benoit. And I would say third would probably be Kurt Angle.
Putting Shawn.
That's a technical wrestler. Yeah. I think Shawn Michaels is the greatest in-ring performer of all time. No one touches Shawn Michaels from an overall landscape of a performer. But I mean, Bret Hart from a technical standpoint, he made everything look so real and legitimate. But from a sports entertainer standpoint, from the entrance to the end of the match, selling, making the other guy look amazing, Bret's right up there with Shawn. But God, I mean, Shawn was he was the prototypical white meat babyface, where he would get the crap kicked out of him for so long. And then that comeback, just the crowd would always eat it up. But in terms of in-ring performers of all time, I have Bret Hart at number two behind Shawn. It's so funny. If you would have asked me that 5 years ago, I'd been like, screw Bret. He's like 30th. I told this to my wife because she's heard me for years just trash Bret Hart. And then about a year ago, we were doing our top 10 favorite wrestlers of all time. And I think I had Bret at like number seven. And everyone that was on the show with me literally gasp, like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, Chris, you're a world-renowned hater of Bret Hart. And then I had to admit, like, look, thinking about it, whenever I like to watch wrestling matches on either then WWE Network or Peacock now, I always find myself watching Bret matches. Always. I just love it. I think he's got a top five wrestling theme song of all time. I love the outfits. Like the one he wore on this night is one of my favorite Bret Hart outfits, with like the splattered white on the black. Oh, it's one of my favorites. My number one favorite of all time is the all pink, literally the all pink connected top to bottom. God, it was so smooth. I think he wore it against Roddy Piper at Mania.
Yes. Yeah. Was that right? I remember that.
Yeah. Against Roddy Piper. God, that's my favorite. That all pink is just so friggin' awesome. And I when I watch Bret Hart now, I'm like, God, I wish there was a wrestler today that worked like Bret.
Well, I I just want to mention something. When you mentioned the Bulldog being there, you know, I don't know if you probably did. They referenced McMahon and Lawler referenced it like, oh, 2 years ago, 1992.
Mm-hmm.
Brett and Bulldog had that incredible Intercontinental Championship match yeah. in Wembley Stadium.
Yeah.
So I was happy to hear them bring that up.
I just watched that match a couple weeks ago.
What a great match.
It really was. When Bulldog went up against somebody that was really good, he had his working boots on. Bulldog was very underrated, but you could tell he really only cared in the ring when he was going up against somebody really good. But it's okay. I mean, a lot of guys do that. So it's not, I don't hold that against him. But all right, here we go.
Okay.
There are only two ways to win this match. When either one man exits the cage by either going through the door, down the steps, or climbing the cage, scaling over the top, and hitting the floor. Obviously, these are the best rules for a cage match, escape only. In the current day WWF, they have four ways to end a match, which is with pinfall, submission added into it. So, which hurts the match when there are so many ways to win. Why have a cage match if you can win by pinfall or submission? What the heck's the point?
Right. So and the referee.
Right.
I keep interrupting him. The referee was not in the match. Nope. He was right outside the cage. Mm-hmm. His function was to open and close the door and to call the winner.
Yep. Just let the workers work. Owen made his entrance first to a round of boos. Brett was hugged by several family members while Lawler pointed out that nobody hugged Owen on his way to the ring. Mm-hmm. Brett gave a shades to the baby of one of his brothers. So here we go. Steel cage match for the WWF World Heavyweight Championship. Brett Hart versus Owen Hart. The winner by escaping the cage after 32 minutes is Brett Hart as he retains the WWF title. So I gave this the highest rating I give is 5 stars, clearly. So 5 star, I mean, fuck Dave Meltzer. He's a piece of shit, but I still like the star system.
Okay.
So it's a 5-star match. If I could give it 10 stars, I'd give it 10 stars.
I'm going to give it 5 stars,
yeah.
But I guess I'm a little biased. Oh my God. Like again, like it's just imagine you and one of your brothers having a match. Imagine your dad and your uncle having to wrestle each other. There was just, it was just constant back and forth, mm-hmm. You know, one crawling to the door, the other one pulling him back. There was hair pulling. There was finger biting at one point.
Yep.
It was a really good match.
It really was. That's as high as a rating as I can give. I mean, I don't give many 5-star, but one of the best matches to me in WWF history. I mean, they were given over 30 minutes to have a classic, and that's what they did. It's not easy to do that in a cage where you are limited by what you can do since you can't go outside the ring. But Brett and Owen made it work. You know, they had a lot of spots where they climbed the cage, making it look like it might end, but then the other guy prevented it from happening. You won't see many cage matches like that where the competitors work such a technical classic within the confines of a cage. At the same time, they made it look like a brawl as well. A lot of people focus on the moves that guys do in a match, but what made this so great was the art of selling. Brett and Owen were selling exhaustion so much in the second half of this match, which is why the crowd, you know, just bought into it so much. Brett said many times that selling is the most important part of having a good match, and he's 1,000,000,000% correct. Hence why I hate AEW, because it's like none of them even know what selling is. I could literally super kick those dudes 155 times, which happens every Wednesday night, I'm sure. And everyone just gets right back up and let's go to the next high spot. I just hate it.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, Brett did no sell at one point. He no sold his strep throat.
That's funny. There were times in the match where one guy was down and the other man could have won the match, but instead they sold the exhaustion angle by collapsing in order to, you know, to tell the story that both were just getting tired, but just wanted to keep beating the crap out of each other.
Sorry.
No, you're good. Go.
other nuances in this steel cage match. At one point, Owen, even though it wasn't going to end up in submission, mm-hmm. Owen put the sharpshooter on Brett. Brett was able to reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
And the commentary, again, like for me, like what brings me back is hearing the commentary, especially for me, the best was Bobby, the Marine Heenan.
Of course.
But at one point, Brett was like disoriented and he's crawling to like the wrong corner and McMahon goes, oh, Brett thinks the door is that way.
Oh, God.
And the King goes, wrong corner, idiot. And at one point, one of them yelled, turnabouts, fair play. Mm-hmm. I've heard Corey Graves say that so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, oh, yeah, that's where that comes
from.
That's
a callback. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, as for the finish, it fit the match because the whole match was pretty even, split down the middle. So it made sense for them to have an ending where Brett barely won rather than winning in dominant manner. You know, there was my favorite part of this match is Brett goes to the top rope and then goes up like two or three rungs of the cage and does a mega superplex onto Owen. And I'm like, geez, just wrap it up here. I mean, you can't get any better than that. I mean, that bump is just so intense. You didn't see that back then in 1994. Now that's every Monday night on Raw or SmackDown. But 1994, you know, going near the top of a cage and doing a superplex off of it, that's a big bump. I mean, that's a hard bump to take. You know, if I can recommend anything to anybody right now, is to go on Peacock. I know the app sucks, but go to Peacock. Go to SummerSlam 94 and skip to this match. If it's the only match you ever watch in your wrestling life, you'll love it. Brett versus Owen, you know, it's just an amazing way to appreciate the story that Brett and Owen told all the way up to this match to end. You know, part of me really wishes Owen would have had a title run, but I know Bruce Pritchard says this often. I used to hate when he says it on his podcast, but it does make sense. Some guys really didn't need the title to be great and to be over. Jake the Snake didn't need a WWF title. Roddy Piper didn't need it. I would have loved to have seen Mr. Perfect because he would have been a great heel champion, but he still didn't need it. I don't look at him any differently. And the same way with Owen. You know, if I wasn't a wrestling fan and someone said to me, oh, yeah, Owen was so great, man, you must have been a great champion. And someone said to me, he never won it. I'd be like, oh, well, that sucks, but I don't care. He's spectacular. Razor Ramon never won a world title. Just insane to think that.
There's plenty.
Oh, yeah, there's plenty. So post-match, Jim Neidhart shoved Davey Boy Smith over the railing with Diana Hart. Bumping over the railing. Neidhart went after Brett at ringside and then rolled Brett into the cage along with Owen. Neidhart locked the cage door. The Hart brothers were outside the ring trying to get in with Owen and Neidhart knocking them down. Smith tried to get in there too. Owen kept on knocking guys off the cage while Lawler said this was the greatest thing he's ever seen. Bulldog.
It was ridiculous.
I know.
You had four Hart brothers, and if you need me to, I can name the four of them, plus the British Bulldog. So you had five men, and Owen somehow they couldn't get to them. Finally, they did, though.
Of the 57 Harts, where's Brett fall? Is he, like, in the middle?
He is, he's in the lower half. He's the third youngest boy. Owen's the youngest, and right somewhere above him is a bunch of girls, and then there's Ross. And so Brett is the third youngest boy, but I can't remember if there's 12, he's somewhere in the lower half.
Mark. this was a great post-match angle too. I thought it was one of those scenes that worked because there was a believability factor of Owen as the jealous brother while Neidhart was jealous of Brett since they were a former tag team. You know, then there were the brothers trying to climb the cage to break it up and they were just unable to do it. The segment was also, I thought, an effective way to welcome back the British Bulldog. So that was good. But yeah, man, I freaking love this match so much. And I just, damn it, I hate how much I love Bret Hart now.
I just got done reading his autobiography for the third time.
Ugh. I remember when you first read it the first time, you called me and you were so disappointed with some of the things that you learned about him. But, you know, hey, look, pro wrestler in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I'm sure he's a saint compared to many of them. In the backstage area, Pettengill tried to interview Owen and Neidhart. Owen complained about how everybody was against him. Neidhart threatened Brett. Owen said they were going to celebrate the victory. It was a great way to keep the story hot. They had Owen team up with Neidhart against Brett and Bulldog several times in the months that followed. And then Neidhart was gone because he probably was on another Coke binge and Vince fired him one of 15 different times. I'm telling you, I think Marty Jannetty and Jim Neidhart have been fired and hired more than any other two wrestlers in the history of the business, which is crazy. Because I think we did it one time. Somebody had it online. Marty Jannetty was hired and rehired 12 times by the WWF. So, you know, people hate on Vince McMahon, but he'll keep giving guys chances, man. He will.
That coward Marty Jannetty.
He tried to escape through the window.
You know, I do remember, and I hate to admit this, losing interest when Bob Backlund entered the picture.
Oh, that was awful. Yeah.
And, you know, seeing him put the crossface chicken wing on Brett, I think, again, that combination of just not liking where some of the stories were going, me getting older. Yeah.
Well, a commercial airs for the Survivor Series 1994 occurring on Thanksgiving Eve. They showed videos leading up to Undertaker versus Undertaker. As I mentioned earlier, the Undertaker, the real one, died and was put in a casket by Yokozuna at the 1994 Royal Rumble and wasn't on TV for the next 7 months. So it's just, that's just wild. 7 months of no Undertaker. It's hard to believe when you look at it now. The story is that Ted DiBiase brought in a fake Undertaker and then Paul Bearer realized that he was a fake. He was a fraud. We've been bamboozled and hoodwinked by Ted DiBiase. So here's a confrontation with Bear bringing back the real Undertaker. DiBiase makes his entrance and introduced the under faker. Paul Bearer makes his entrance with the one, the only, the Undertaker, according to the announcer, Howard Finkel, rest in peace. Bear had some druids bring out a casket that they brought to the ring. When the casket opened, Bear brought out an urn with Lawler saying he doesn't have an Undertaker. The lights went out. Bear opened the urn as a spotlight came from the inside. Whew, 1994. The real Undertaker enters the match. Just for clarification, moving forward, I'll say Undertaker or Taker for the real one, and I'll say Underfaker for the fake one. It was almost given away completely when the real Undertaker came out and you heard like emphatically Vince McMahon saying, now there's the real Undertaker. It's like, can I at least get to the stare down in the middle of the ring so I can decide?
But I think what really helped sell it, because to me, the beginning, what you just described, the spectacle was in the entrance. That was the main part of the match.
Yep.
The look on Ted DiBiase's face, he really sold it.
He really did.
Yeah, this like, oh my God, look on his face. Mm-hmm. What have I gotten myself into?
Yep.
And it was, it wasn't horrible to me.
You don't think it wasn't horrible?
So I'm sure that you already have the information and the statistics, but Brian Lee,
yes,
was they were the best fake friends. Undertaker.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I mean, look, I've heard Mark Calaway say before what a challenge it is to play the character of the Undertaker in the wrestling ring.
Yeah.
Because he has to move so slow and so methodically. I mean, so many of the things that he does, like the sit up.
Yep.
Which they got
from Mike Myers, by the way. Did you know that?
Yep.
I
know it's now called old school, but yes, him walking the ropes, that's an incredible thing to see. Even now.
Yeah.
So Brian Lee had to be trained to be able to move like that. So I think we've got to give him a little bit of credit.
That's a great point. He was really kind of put in a lose-lose situation in a way. But I will say the illusion was done once the lights came on. And as soon as they showed like a, I don't know why they decided to show a close up of Brian Lee. They should never have shown like his face super close up under that hat once the lights came on, because it was boom, done. Just like that, you knew, well, that definitely ain't the Undertaker. So since you kind of convinced me, I'm going to change my star rating, I guess. Thanks a lot. I was going to give this a negative two. So I'm going to bump this up to a one Zero? Star.
Okay.
I'll give it a one star because it's just so etched in my brain. And I still watch this like once a year. It's ridiculous. So to me, I'm going to give it a one star because it was an awful match. It was like Nancy, you said, it was a spectacle more than anything. They weren't really able to tell a story from a working standpoint. The whole thing was, I thought, kind of really cheesy, even for WWF storylines in 1994. I remember watching it again a couple years ago, and I remember it being pretty bad then, but I still loved it. And then I watched it again last week, and it was really bad, but I still love it. And I don't know why.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
How do you think they should have done it? How would you have liked to have seen it done to have it play out better or differently?
I don't think you could. I don't know what you just not have the match.
I did read something because, again, I really wanted to do my homework and be prepared for this. The ending was supposed to be different, where they were supposed to somehow merge into one Undertaker.
That would have been way worse.
Taker would have absorbed the Faker somehow. And, you know, so I mean, I don't know. It's interesting.
I don't know how you could have. Yeah, the only way to fix it is just to not do it. I mean, honestly, it's a great, what you just said is probably what the Undertaker asked. Like, is there anything else we can do? And I'm my point would have been in like, I don't know. The only other thing we can do is not have it. Because that's the only problem is that, look, I give a lot of leeway to wrestling. And the fact of that is I still watch. I mean, when you're 35, you've been watching wrestling for 30 years, you know, over 35 years for you.
Thank you.
You forgive. you forgive a lot of shit that you see on their television on pro wrestling. I mean, you have to suspend your disbelief. You have to suspend all logic. And this is like the line for me, this match. This is like, I'm so happy it was never done again. I thought it worked amazingly well when it was a couple years later when they brought Kane in a mask as his brother. Now he's not Undertaker. He's not another one. He's his brother. It worked. Greatest rivalry in the history of wrestling. That rivalry lasted, and they were a team for 20 years. And it worked for 20 years. So it's the only other way it would have worked is if it came out that the Undertaker was like his brother. But thank God they didn't do that, because they might have steered away from doing it with Kane, you know, 3 years later. But yeah, look, you know, there's a reason why WWF almost never mentions this story when talking about the Undertaker's history. They never talk about it. You know, they knew it was bad. I think they knew it was bad. It really was one of the worst matches I thought ever. It was a terrible, terrible way to end this show. I know the return of the Undertaker is a big, big deal, but this was a big miss not ending that show with Owen and Bret. It was a big, big miss here. I would have put this match, dead honestly, I would have put this match where they put Diesel and Razor, and I would have ended the show with the second to last match would have been Diesel and Razor with Walter Payton being in Chicago. Oh,
okay.
And then the main event would have been Bret and Owen. The
Diesel, sorry.
No, it's all right. Go ahead.
Diesel and Razor were third. They came on before Tatanka and Lex, and they came on before Double J and Mabel.
Right. I would have put the Undertaker versus Undertaker right there, and I don't think there would have been a problem. I don't.
I don't know. I think it could have made the rest of the pay-per-view pretty anticlimactic because, again, we go back to the idea of long-term storytelling.
Yeah.
This was a seven-month buildup. Where's The Undertaker? Mm-hmm. You know, is he, you know, and like I said, I remember the magazine having pictures of him, like, at the Taj Mahal.
Oh, that's right. And, yeah.
and all these crazy places.
Oh, man.
So, like, I'm feeling a little bit more lenient about it. Mm. Also, another fact that I read, when they had Brian Lee, the fake Undertaker, practicing, they had him practice with the guy who came to be Just Incredible.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. PJ something is his name. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
very good. Thank you for that. Stop bringing up all these facts that I don't talk about. So post-match, DiBiase ran away while the Druids came back out. Taker put Faker into the casket at ringside, and that was the end of the Underfaker.
Thank God.
The Shot went backstage where Nielsen and Kennedy were hanging around. They opened the casket to see there was nothing inside. Then Kennedy pointed out that the case and told Nielsen that the case was closed, and that ended the show. Out of a 10, Nance, what do you give this show?
Oh gosh.
You want me to go first?
Yeah.
5. I give the show a 5 out of 10.
Okay. See,
because of Brett and Owen.
Chris knows so much more than I do, I feel. like when it comes to certain things. I was actually thinking like maybe like a 7.
Misspent youth, Nance. Misspent youth. Instead of going out to parties, I was going to West Coast Video and renting WWF pay-per-views.
So was I. But yeah. I mean, I guess me and you were watching for different reasons. Mm-hmm. But you know, when I think about, okay, so I saw SummerSlam the other night,
mm-hmm.
and it just, for me, I guess I base it on all on how I feel afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at it from more of a personal standpoint than a technical one.
I see.
And like the match with Wonder Blaze and Bull Nakano was so good.
It was.
And, you know, for me, and maybe there was a little bit of nostalgia for me, mm-hmm. you know, to see like Bam Bam again.
Yeah.
What else? The match between, who was it? Diesel and Razor Ramon was really good.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so, and of course, Brett and Owen. So I think maybe that's why I have mine as high as I do, because again, it going based just off of a personal nostalgic level. I'm somebody who again, most of the time, even now, I have to be honest, I'm rooting for the face.
Mm-hmm. I understand. Yeah.
Brock Lesnar and Roman Reigns. Right. I'm always going to root for Roman Reigns.
Understood. But
again, for different reasons than you.
Right. I was rooting for Roman as well. It was to me, I thought this pay-per-view was the highs and lows of the mid-90s of WWF. You had one of the best matches ever, and then one of the worst main events ever in the same show. It was a very rare, it's rare. But you know, look, it was what it was. They were a storytelling company, which they've always been. So the Undertaker, like Nancy said, the Undertaker versus Undertaker was just a big story, but still. Brett versus Owen, legitimate brother versus brother, the WWF title on the line in a cage match. Anywhere in the world, that should be your headliner. So that's just how I feel.
I think that like when you were saying earlier about how like those were some of Brett's best promos. Again, like to me, it's like, you know, because. You know how like with writers, they say, know your topic, know what you're writing about.
Yeah.
I feel like with this, like Brett and Owen knew everything about each other. And, you know, I think for Brett, it was personal.
Yeah.
In the way that like, he could have more fun with it.
I agree. All right. So that wraps up this episode. This wraps up SummerSlam 1994. Next week we will be talking about SummerSlam 2001. The main event of that match was Booker T defending the WCW championship against The Rock. Kurt Angle defeated Stone Cold Steve Austin on that pay-per-view. The Brothers of Destruction, Kane and The Undertaker, defeated Diamond Dallas Page and Chris Kanyon. Rest in peace. Also on that show was a ladder match, Rob Van Dam versus Jeff Hardy. Another Edge defeated Lance Storm that night. But yeah, we're going to be talking about that. That was literally a few months after WWF purchased and ended WCW. Very, very popular pay-per-view, this SummerSlam one. 570,000 pay-per-view buy. So it was big money. But we will talk about that next week. George and Dean will be back. And I have to say, I think Nancy will probably be back on again soon whenever we're not covering an Attitude Era pay-per-view. All right,
deal.
Although, you know what's funny? I'm going to take that back. On another show, I'm going to make you watch an Attitude Era pay-per-view.
I'll do my homework.
Okay,
yeah,
and they're going to review.
I mean, I would really appreciate it if Edge could be part of that.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, it's anywhere between like 98 and like 2010, Edge is going to be part of it, most likely.
All right. Again, watching for slightly different reasons than other people.
Yeah, I know. It's okay. But as long as you can come in here and act like you can analytically talk about it, we're good. All right, guys, thank you so much. Hot Tag Podcast on Instagram. That's where I post the shows. Anywhere you guys listen to podcasts in the world, you guys can check it out. Thank you for all the downloads each and every week. I really do appreciate this. Again, Hot Tag Podcast on Instagram. I'll post this probably tomorrow morning, and you guys will get it within minutes. So definitely check this one out. Next week, we're going to be back, same time, and we're going to enter. It's like a complete difference between 94 and 2001. And looking forward to talking about that. All right. So I'm Chris DeFrancesco. That's Nancy DeFrancesco. And I'll catch you guys down the road. Have a great rest of your week and weekend. Be safe. Bye-bye.